She says she felt trapped. She'd been trading in secrets for so long. And if that currency dried up, she worried police would have no use for her and would quit protecting her. It seems with Nicola, this pattern of fear and dependence has repeated. First with her gangland clients, then with police.
So I found myself having sought some kind of intervention assistance from an organisation that I thought would help me and protect me. That morphed into a situation where I, over time, became not just frightened of them, but I felt like my life, and my life as I knew it, was dependent upon them.
Do you take any responsibility for any of it? I've read bits in handlers' diaries that suggest that there were times that handlers wanted to back off. They thought things were too dangerous, and you sensed that. You sensed that pulling away, so you gave more, you pushed more. You know, is that something inherent in you that you so desperately needed, or wanted to be needed?
They, the police, had this hold over me, which is, you know, put me in a room with them and I feel like I've got to prove myself. It's almost like they would challenge me by saying, we don't really believe that, or are you sure? And that would, knowing my personality, which is, well, if you give me a challenge, I'll rise to it. I think they did manipulate me in that way because they knew me very well.
In other words, Nicola sort of admits that she willingly, maybe even enthusiastically, kept informing. But she says she did this because of her fears and insecurities. And she says Victoria Police would have known all about those fears and insecurities. And she accuses the force of knowingly exploiting them.
Victoria Police, you know, in a way manipulated me or stood back and allowed me to be, or helped me be manipulated into that position. I'm not saying I don't bear some responsibility at all. That's not, I don't want to come across as saying that. But I think, you know, knowing what I know now about their tactics and about obviously what happened as time went on, and, you know, I got played.
Even the treats, she looks back on bitterly now. Like the gift of the stinking pen, as she now calls it, and the golf club dinner.
Yep, what an awful night that was. Didn't eat anything and barely drank. I don't think I drank anything. And then I got a silver pen. You know, watch them all get pissed and thinking, what? It's just insane.
There's a kind of pattern in Nicola's thinking here that's played out a few times at the Royal Commission. Nicola would say that the police had asked her to do something or threatened her.
You said that on the 13th of June this year to the Commissioner that you were petrified of Mr. White and he threatened to burn you if you didn't trust him. All right? Remember saying that?
Yes.
But then, when pressed, she'd sometimes admit it was more a vibe. She'd claim that they manipulated her to feel threatened or to feel like she had to prove herself. One of the clearest examples of this came when Nicola was talking about Sandy White, the handler she was closest to. In the space of a day at the Royal Commission, she initially said that she was scared of him after their first meeting.
Initially, I walked away petrified of Mr. White and to a lesser degree of Mr. Smith.
But then she changed that slightly. She wasn't so much scared of him as scared about her future.
I walked away scared, or scared of what might happen if I didn't meet their expectations.
And then later at the Royal Commission, she settled on saying that she was scared of just letting him down.
Look, it's a bit embarrassing to admit, but I think my biggest fear of Mr. White was disappointing him.
She not only sought his approval, she trusted him to keep his word. But he'd secretly recorded their very first meeting when he said he wouldn't. And when she was at rock bottom, he referred her to a psychologist.
He said that it was an operational health and welfare issue and that he needed to satisfy his bosses that I was travelling okay, I guess is the best way to put it.
But Nicola found out the psychologist wasn't just there to help her.
But fundamentally the problem was that she was reporting back to my handlers.
She also discovered that one of the senior officers who considered visiting her in hospital after her stroke, thinking she might be vulnerable for recruitment, was Sandy White.
Victoria Police hierarchy decided that it was appropriate to visit me when I was in the high dependency unit in hospital, unable to speak after my stroke on the 24th of July 2004, to pressure me to become an informer.
They didn't end up doing it, but they thought about it. The man she'd looked up to as a father figure had thought about it, and for Nicola, that was disgusting enough.
And what do you say to that? That's cold.
Sandy White was genuinely worried about Nicola. She'd lost 49 kilograms since she started working with the police.
She was under a lot of stress and that impacted on her physically.
Yes.
There were times she would report that she couldn't sleep and she was grinding her teeth.
As her health worsened, the handler's notes describe how the usually chatty Nicola had gone deadly quiet. She was depressed, finding it hard to get off the couch, and using too much morphine to control the facial pain she'd been left with after her stroke.
When Miss Gobbo made that fateful decision on 16 September 2005 to provide information to the police in this way, it was a total catastrophe from Miss Gobbo's point of view.
That's definitely how it's turned out, yes. With the benefit of hindsight, there's a number of reasons why this relationship shouldn't have been embarked upon, at least without much better support.
Nicola provided intel on 164 people over the course of almost 4 years. No other informer had been on the books for that long. By the end of 2008, she was at rock bottom. She probably should have been in hospital. But instead, Force Command pushed her to do one last job. In the next episode, police get Nicola to secretly record a conversation with an old flame, a detective who was a police suspect in the infamous Hodson murders.
You think that there's something I'm hiding about any of this? My response was fine. Well, record it. You record it, I will.
Season 2 of Trace, The Informer is hosted by me, Rachel Brown. My reporting partner is Josie Taylor. Supervising producer for post-production is Tim Roxburgh. Our producer is Yasmin Parry. Producer for the 7:30 interview was Chris Gillette. Camera, photos and sound on that interview by Greg Nelson. We get production support from Will Ockenden. Fact-checking and research by Alexander Tai. And our sound design and theme composition was done by Martin Peralta. Additional music by Seapelt, Nicole Carroll, Land Systems, Lincoln J.K. Weber, Jay Curtis, R. Domain, and Martin Peralta. If you like Trace, leave us a review wherever you get your podcast and subscribe to get new episodes as soon as they land.